Welcome to Straight Thinking, a GPS for the Christian mind, teaching you how to think, not what to think. This is Average Joe Aguirre with theologian and philosopher Kenneth Samples and physicist Dave Rogstad. On today's podcast, three things you may not know about C.S. Lewis. Ken takes a closer look at the 20th century Christian writer and fills us in on some fascinating details. All right, Ken, if I'm typical, I've read at least several Lewis books, but always wanting to know more about the person. So I think that's where you're going to take us today, right?
Yeah, I noticed something about myself. I like to study philosophy and theology and apologetics and history and lots of topics. But I also know, Joe, that I like to connect it to a person. That is, I don't like to just study analytic philosophy. I want to study Plato. I want to study Aristotle, Augustine. And I think a lot of times the person kind of gives you a little bit of understanding of why did he come up with that idea and what were the events of his life. So like we did a number of shows ago to Athanasius, I thought we would do kind of a snapshot. And I want to start with what I hope kind of pulls our listeners in, and that is maybe there are three things I'm going to tell you in this podcast that you don't know about C.S. Lewis.
Mm, wow, okay, intriguing. You like that number three also.
I do like three. One and three. Three and one. I love that. I think that C.S. Lewis is arguably the most influential Christian apologist of the 20th century. But I'm going to go even further. He'd have some competition. Francis Schaeffer's pretty popular writer of the 20th century in Christian apologetics, and there would be a few others that might compete with him in that context. But I'm going to go even further. I think he might be the most influential Christian writer of the 20th century. Now, again, some big names in the 20th century, a name we don't often mention, Karl Barth had a huge influence in theology. But Lewis, I think, has this enduring influence. His book, Mere Christianity, there was a book that came out not too long ago by the historian George Marsden, who wrote about the influence of the book, Mere Christianity. And he said that it was voted the most influential Christian book of the 20th century by Christianity Today magazine. And he said, even after 2001, it had sold more than 3 million copies. So could I propose, and I think I can make a case for this, I think if C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien were alive today, they'd both be billionaires. Mm-hmm. And the reason, look at J.K. Rowling. Her book, she's now a billionaire. Mm-hmm. And these books are incredibly enduring. In fact, I did a little research. The Chronicles of Narnia have sold more than 100 million copies. Wow. 100 million. Mm. Then I looked up The Lord of the Rings by J.R.R. Tolkien, and he's sold 150 million. Mm. These are some of the most influential popular writings in the history of the world. And if they were writing today, making movies, of course, both of them were wealthy at the end of their life because they were taking in royalties. Mm-hmm. But Lewis has had an enduring influence, and
I'm getting royalties, by the way, for the book that I was involved in writing. I get like $50, maybe once every couple of years.
You know, when I want to refresh my Greek, I open up your physics text, and I know I had a guy contact me long ago, and he said the thing I liked most about your book, God Among Sages, is a footnote that you had where you mentioned that people disagreed with you, and he was praising me for admitting that people disagreed. And I thought, you know, on my tombstone, I might put, he read my endnotes. So if I've had a half a dozen people, I figure maybe 10 or 12 have read the book, right? As opposed to 100 million?
I know, it's remarkable, isn't it?
Well, as I've shared before, Dave and I and a throng of RTB people visited England in May of 2018, and I had a great time there, Joe. going to Oxford really is an amazing place. It's an amazing place for a couple different reasons. It's called Oxford because it was out in a field with a bunch of ox. That's how the name came.
Ford, it's, yeah, there was a split in the river, and there were,
yeah,
there was a ford there, and Oxford.
Oh, okay.
So it's a medieval city in the Middle Ages, and it is also arguably the most prestigious university in the world, maybe competition with Cambridge, which is about a couple hours away. But, you know, Dave and I were able to walk into the Bird and the Baby. That's the little pub that the Inklings met, people like Tolkien and Charles Williams, Owen Barfield, Hugo Dyson, and they would talk about what they were writing and get feedback. And, you know, a lot of things have come out about Lewis. Tolkien has said about C.S. Lewis that he probably would never have finished The Lord of the Rings had it not been for C.S. Lewis. Lewis was kind of a handmaid. Tolkien was a very fastidious person, and Lewis really encouraged him. And said, hey, this is really good. You got to get it out. In fact, we discovered in 1960, a lot of people didn't know this, but Lewis nominated Tolkien for a Nobel Prize in 1960. So, you know, going there, I realized, wow, and I would rub my arm on the wall hoping the Inkling magic would come over to Ken Samples and Joe would pick up my manuscript and say, aha!
You'll fit that into your worldview somehow.
I will. I was hoping to get that. Well, as I've mentioned, we also went to Holy Trinity Anglican Church. We went to the kilns where Lewis lived. And, you know, I was joking with a friend of mine the other day. I said, do you think anybody's going to go to Riverside and say, this is where Ken Samples lived? I mean, there's a throng of people, everybody wanting to, that's the kilns, I want to get in there. Pretty cool stuff. And I think it's great that someone who is such an intellectual, and I think Lewis's claim to fame really was as a scholar that, you know, more than 50 years after his death, people are still interested in what he writes. And I can tell you as an author, the other day I got an email, actually it was on Facebook, and a young man in the Philippines, they were using my book, Without a Doubt, in a Christology class. And he said that it had been very helpful in the Philippines. I've heard before, but he said it as well, that Arianism and Jehovah's Witnesses, if you will, is very popular in parts of Asia, and they were using my book. And as an author, you think, yeah, I've put my heart and soul in this, and then you hear that far away in some other land, somebody's reading it, thinking about it. Well, all of us have had that experience with C.S. Lewis.
Has Lewis's scholarly work, the works, not the ones that we read, but the ones that the scholars read, is that still considered to be important or valuable?
Yes. Yes, it is. In fact, I'll say a bit more about that in a few minutes, but The Allegory of Love that he published in 1936, The Oxford History of the English Literature in the 16th Century that he published in 1954, mm-hmm. are still viewed very highly. And that kind of leads me into the first point that I want to tell you that you may not know about C.S. Lewis. And of course, this is what Owen Barfield said about C.S. Lewis. Owen Barfield was a student at Oxford very early when he and Lewis were just teenagers, late teens. I think Lewis was there when he was 19. Barfield was a student there, and Barfield was so bright that he was one of the few people that C.S. Lewis would allow to correct him. And Barfield embraced anthroposophy, which is a kind of philosophical system around Rudolf Steiner. So Barfield never became a Christian. But this is what Owen Barfield said about C.S. Lewis, and it's the first thing you may not know about him. There were really three C.S. Lewises.
Uh-oh, okay. Wait a minute.
Three C.S. Lewises. One person, three Lewises,
oh,
if you will.
All right.
Well, this, of course, is brought out by Alistair McGrath. I was reading about Alistair McGrath the other day on Wikipedia. McGrath has three doctorates, one in science, another one in letters, and another doctoral degree in theology, all from Oxford University. Mm. So in McGrath's biography of Lewis, he really kind of understands the Oxford, world. And McGrath, of course, is also an Irishman. I probably should have put four things you may not know about C.S. Lewis. A lot of people think Lewis was a British writer. He was an Irishman. He was born in Belfast, Ireland, and he was always rather put off by the British. He always wanted to, connect himself back to that wonderful land of Ireland. But McGrath, who has, I think, a lot of great insight about Lewis, and I'm going to encourage you to consider his biography, C.S. Lewis, A Life. In that book, he quotes Barfield, and Barfield says that there were three C.S. Lewises. And here is where I think we tie this in. I know at Reasons to Believe, I'm not the only one who reads C.S. Lewis here at Reasons to Believe. You've read a lot of C.S. Lewis. You've read a lot of C.S. Lewis. There are other people at RTB. But what's interesting is when I talk to people who read Lewis, they often read one area of his life. Like, mm-hmm. Some of the editors, Sandra and Maureen, have read more of Lewis's fictional writing. So they know C.S. Lewis through the Chronicles of Narnia primarily. My emphasis is more in his theology and apologetics, miracles, the problem of pain, mere Christianity. Now, what Barfield says is that the first C.S. Lewis is the author, the best-selling author of children's novels, The Chronicles of Narnia. And again, when you can say that 100 million people have read your works. I was talking with Fuzz Rana the other day, and Fuzz and I have just completed a book together. And I was saying that often when I'm writing, I'm just trying to get it out onto the paper. I'm just trying to get the content out. I don't feel I'm very skilled at going back and kind of putting it into prose and, writing in such a way that it will really grip people. And, I'm at times amazed that Lewis could write in a particular way and give so much attention to detail about turns of phrases. And C.S. Lewis said that he never wanted to use a typewriter because it would destroy your style of writing, that it would get in the way. It would be interesting if Lewis and Tolkien live now, and the word processor. Right. And Tolkien may never have finished The Lord of the Rings with a word processor. He'd be changing things.
Well, that's why there were three C.S. Lewis. Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Well, you have the first C.S. Lewis, and I think most people, this is the C.S. Lewis that they know. He's the author of children's novels. And, I was reading the other day that Lewis got a lot of fan mail. In fact, Walter Hooper, Lewis's secretary at the end of Lewis's life, Hooper said that Lewis may have written as many as 10,000 letters to people who had contacted him. Can you imagine that? 10,000 letters. He'd write them out by hand, and Lewis's older brother, Warney, would type them out. And that's what they do in the morning. They'd get up, have their tea, some crumpets, the proper British breakfast, right? I noticed when we were at Oxford, the lunch was pretty limited. There wasn't a lot of food given to you at that point. Kind of a biscuit, and I'm like, wow, by the way, Alistair McGrath says that it was not, it was Walter Hooper who said, Lewis might drink three pots of tea a day.
Pots.
Pots.
Wow.
Where you heat up the pot. Yeah. Now, it's, they're about that big or so, not terribly big, but that's a lot of tea
no
drinking.
No wonder he didn't drive. He had to stay anchored to the restroom.
He said, a famous quote from him, he said, I've never found a book long enough or a cup big enough to suit me. He liked drinking tea.
Reading long books.
Reading long books. So the first C.S. Lewis is the author of children's novels, The Chronicles of Narnia. Lewis used to get letters from kids, and the kids would say, I hate to say this, but Mr. Lewis, I think I love Aslan more than Jesus. And Lewis would write back and say, that's okay, Aslan is Jesus. But, you know, 10,000 letters. And one thing that I've learned, Lewis used to say that if you write a book and somebody writes to you, you have an obligation to write back to them. Mm. You've engaged them. Now you need to kind of respond to them. And I thought, wow, I never really thought that way about being an author. And so I tried now to take a little more attention when somebody, you know, sends me an email or has a gripe about my book. I say, well, it's the editors. I didn't write that. No. I blame it on Joe Aguirre.
Right, there you go.
There's another C.S. Lewis. The second one is the C.S. Lewis that I think I know the best. And that's the C.S. Lewis I think about. And that's the Christian writer of theology and apologetics. That's the lay Anglican theologian and the apologist. I grew up in a nominal Catholic family. I wasn't catechized. My family kind of fell away from their Catholic faith. And so I went to church on holy days, you know, Christmas and Easter and the really important times. But I didn't really understand my Catholic views, though I was never an atheist. In my neighborhood, if you said anything bad about Jesus, you'd get in trouble. But none of us lived, you know, a Christian life. At least I didn't. So my sister gave me a copy of Mere Christianity, and it sat on my shelf a long time. I was a young college student, and I started reading. I picked it up and started reading it, and the thing that struck me was how careful Lewis was, that he was writing about ideas, and he was very careful and kind of thought, had you think through various issues. Well, that's the C.S. Lewis I know, Mere Christianity, The Problem of Pain, Miracles. This is the defender of the Christian faith. And not just the defender, also the explainer of the Christian faith. I mean, in Mere Christianity, he told me about the Trinity. He taught me about Christian values and things of that nature. So that's the C.S. Lewis that I think about. That's the Lewis that I connect to most. But then there's a third C.S. Lewis, and this may be the Lewis that possibly Lewis thought the most about himself. I think Barfield thought that this was the real C.S. Lewis. And that is the Oxford Don, the literary scholar of medieval and Renaissance literature. He wrote, as I mentioned, The Allegory of Love in 1936. In 1954, The Oxford History of English Literature and in the 16th century. So this is the C.S. Lewis, the literary scholar. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what comes out of this is, in reading the biography of Alistair McGrath, Lewis served in World War I. And this is now going to lead me into the second thing you may not know about C.S. Lewis. But Lewis served in World War I. And I think he suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder. In those days, they called it shell shock or combat fatigue. So in the movie Patton, when Patton slaps the soldier who says, you know, he's nervous, Patton shouldn't have done that. You don't have to be actually physically wounded to be wounded in mind and soul by terrible wars. So Lewis, interestingly, doesn't say much. There's a book, Surprised by Joy. I know, Dave, you've read that book. That's Lewis's autobiography. And Lewis doesn't say a lot about World War I. It's kind of a glaring omission, if you will. In fact, he says that the boarding schools he went to as a kid were much worse than the battlefields of World War I. Now, there's a lot of psychology in that. You know, I think Lewis got bullied. Lewis was not very athletic, and some of the schools he went to, you were measured by whether you're a ball player, right? These eggheads, you know, Lewis was an egghead. He wasn't much of an athlete. But I think what we see And I think that this is very common. I've mentioned a couple times on our program here that with my dad never shared with his entire family that he had received three medals in the war. At my dad's funeral, his brothers came up and they were like, I didn't even know this about your dad. I knew he was in the war, but he never talked about it. And I think the reality is, because who wants to dredge up all of those traumatic experiences in your mind? I think Lewis, and like so many soldiers of World War I and World War II, they were trying to keep it, clamp it down, to keep it from overcoming them. And what's interesting is that Lewis does mention that reading poetry was a way of kind of keeping him sane. And as I've mentioned before, Jonathan Edwards talks about beauty. Beauty has a way of shaping you and moving you outside of yourself and allowing to heal you. I think Lewis thought that literature and the books he were reading really had a deep influence on him. So the second point I want to make of the three things you may not know about C.S. Lewis, and of course I like this because I have a deep appreciation for soldiers. I just think that they have so much to bear. The second point you may not know about C.S. Lewis is that he was a patriot of the United Kingdom in two wars.
Wow.
In two world wars. Now, let me tell you what I mean by that. Lewis was born in 1898. So in 1914, when World War I started, the war to end all wars, this incredible conflict that involved all the major powers of Europe, not America initially. America came in 1917, but the war began in 1914. Lewis was 16 years old. By the time of 1917, he's 19 years old, and he's trying to get into Oxford, at that point, Everybody was drafted between the ages of 18 and 41.
So if you were able-bodied, you were drafted in.
You were drafted in. And Lewis became an officer in the Somerset Light Infantry. And, of course, what's interesting about all of this, some of these little details, is Lewis's father, who supported Lewis a good bit of his life financially, was an attorney. Lewis and he had not a good relationship. One of the things I've learned about C.S. Lewis by reading McGrath is Lewis was a real human being and a sinner and had a difficult life, like all of us have a difficult life. You know, I had a guy the other day ask me on Facebook, are you walking in the steps of the Lord Jesus Christ? And I said, well, I'm a broken sinner, saved by grace, and I seek to follow the Lord, but that the obedience that I have is very incomplete. I'm trusting more in Christ's obedience because mine's kind of up and down and all around. Well, Lewis was a broken guy. He lost his mom when he was 9 years old. He had a very distant relationship with his father. I think his father meant well, but when his wife died, he sent his two sons off to a boarding school. And I think Lewis and Warney really resented it. They thought, you don't care about us. You're sending us away.
Were his growing up years at a boarding school?
Largely at a boarding school.
Without parents, essentially.
Without parents.
Oh, I
yeah.
see. Okay.
And he felt kind of bullied. He felt like, you know, he only had one little in his thumb. He wasn't very supple and he wasn't a ball player. And, he felt like he got bullied because he was, you know, an egghead. I remember when I was growing up, I'm an introvert, and I thought, I'm an introvert in an extrovert's world. You know, I'm trapped. I don't find it easy to talk in front of people and do all of these things. I think Lewis had a lot of struggles, and that was kind of, I don't know, liberating for me to read that, you know, your heroes, they have struggles too. So Lewis wants to go in the military, wants to do his part. His father tries to get him into the to get him out of the infantry, and to get him into the area. And now I'm blanking the term. To get him into the area where they would shoot the artillery in an artillery outfit. Now, here's why. His dad thought if he's in artillery, he'll be far away from the front lines, mm-hmm. and he may survive. And the reality is, the more I've read about World War I, young lieutenants, the death rate was extremely high. It's true in Korea. It's true in World War II. It was true in Vietnam. Why? Because you got here, you got a second lieutenant. They're brand new, and they got a lead, and so they got to stand up and lead their men, and they just get picked off.
You might make a comment about the nature of that war, trench warfare, long lines. Soldiers there for a long period of time.
That's exactly right. Trench fever. They introduced J.R.R. Tolkien. I just find it interesting that Lewis and Tolkien are both officers in the British Army in World War II. Well, Lewis gets wounded, an artillery shell, and I think I've got this right. I think it was a British shell that went off and wounded severely C.S. Lewis. But Tolkien got trench fever. A virus. And so both of them, maybe providentially, right, God intervening to keep them from the fate of so many people in World War One. I think there were 11 million soldiers died in World War One. But, you know, Lewis went in and he served in the military. He was wounded. And I think World War One deeply shaped those people. And, you know, as influential, I'm always startled when people don't know much about World War II, because I think it's the largest event in the history of the world. It was fought on, what, six continents, on all oceans. It's the largest event in history. And I think if you don't know who Churchill was, or FDR, or Stalin, or Hitler, where's your education been? But what's interesting is I think maybe World War One had even a bigger influence in the way people thought about life. Certainly Lewis and Tolkien were in that situation. Now, I mentioned Lewis was a patriot in two world wars. He didn't serve in World War II, because born in 1898, when the war broke out in 1939, he was 41. But see, you could be drafted up into that point, and Lewis was a bit concerned that he might get drafted back into World War II. His brother Warney did, who was a reserve in the military.
He was older, but he was a service.
He was a serviceman. Well, Lewis didn't get drafted, but what did C.S. Lewis do? Well, he did a couple things. He was asked to come and speak to the RAF military guys, the Royal Air Force, Britain's Royal Air Force. And I can tell you that if you were in the Royal Air Force, that is, if you were on these planes, your death rate was sky high. So Lewis would go out to the bases and talk to these Royal Air Force young guys. You know, he's 40, and they're probably 18, 19, 20 years old, looks in the eye, and he knows most of you aren't going to come back. So he starts talking about, you know what, what's life all about? What will happen to us after death? And Lewis says that, you know, here he is, an Oxbridge scholar. I'm using that unique term because he taught at Oxford. He was a tutor, a lecturer at Oxford, and then later in his life he went to Cambridge, so we call him an Oxbridge. Well, Lewis said that he had to think about how to communicate clearly, because these were not Oxford scholars he was talking to. These were young men, some of them not so educated, and so he would give these talks. And you can go on the web, and you'll see C.S. Lewis standing with a group of REF folks, and I think, wow, what do you do when you realize that you're going out to give a talk, and a lot of these young men are not going to come back? What do you say to them? And C.S. Lewis said something that I really enjoyed because it's something I believe deeply in. And that is, Lewis said that you really don't know something unless you can explain it so that the non-professionals can understand it. And I thought, wow, that's really a really important idea. Maybe you really begin to understand something when you can grasp it as a scholar, but then you can begin to break it down so that other people can partake of it. So Lewis would go and talk with the RAF pilots and various people. He also was invited to go on the BBC, the British Broadcasting Company, and give talks during the Second World War. I remind people that from September 1st, 1939 was when World War II began. From 39 to 42, the Axis was winning. The inklings began discussions when the Germans invade our island, which of our books will be put on the forbidden reading list? So, you know, Britain stood alone. There was a time when America had not yet decided to back them. And, you have to give a lot of credit to the mettle of the British people to stand up to Hitler. And I look at Churchill, who was a broken, fallen man, but an extraordinary leader of the country. Well, Lewis was invited to go on the British Broadcasting Company, and he gave regular talks, some of them entitled The Case for Christianity, where he would talk about Christian doctrine, he would talk about the truth of the Christian faith, and these, he wrote out and read his little presentations. Well, after the war, these are taken and massaged and added, and they become Mere Christianity.
Wow.
So Mere Christianity first appears as these presentations on the BBC.
Now, who would have heard the BBC presentations?
All of the Britain, okay. All people in Britain. It was the flagship of the British people. And those talks were so influential. The people at the station, they really liked Lewis. They thought he was very important. And after the war, I think in 1945, 46, Winston Churchill wanted to give Lewis a medal. He thought that he had played a very significant role. And Lewis declined. He declined to take it. But what a patriot, right? So maybe that's something you don't know about C.S. Lewis. Lewis wrote an article, I think it's in God in the Docks. You have to check that, but I think it's in God in the Docks, Why I Am Not a Pacifist. So he was a patriot serving in World War I that really influenced him, and then serving in World War II in terms of being an encourager and talking about, when life is really tough, you need something that you can hold on to.
Yeah. Well, we have spiritual people to guide, chaplains is what I'm getting
yes.
at, to
yes.
help in some regard. But we've come a long way to I assume this is the government backing the station,
yes.
BBC.
Yes.
To that kind of program where they invite Lewis to give talks on Christian doctrine, and that's received very well everywhere. imagine our government inviting you, Ken, to go.
Yeah.
This is going to rally our troops and help morale.
That's right. Well, there were people that reacted to
it. Oh, is that right?
There were unbelievers that thought, why is the government supporting this kind of thing? Why is this on the BBC? But it was such a positive response overall. And I think, the people at a time of crisis like that are more willing to think of the religious aspects. I was watching a program just the other day on public television called G.I. Jews. Maybe you've seen
yes,
it. It's
yes.
a two-hour program on 500,000 Jewish people, Americans, that served in World War II in the Army and the Navy and the Air Force during World War II, and just the reaction that people had to them. But, it's kind of like the blacks serving,
yeah.
and there's a reaction, why are they in here? What are we? the Jews, of course, were mixed in with everybody. But it was just interesting to see how, you know, what motivated them, and how they were received and how they played such an important role in carrying out the things, the activities of World War II.
And as I invite people to consider, what if the Axis had won the war? How many Jews would have died? Would there be any Jews alive today?
That's right.
You know, 70 million killed. So Lewis played a significant role. He took his faith, and, you know, he was a scholar, but he admired those young men. He had been one of those young men in the previous war. He realized that when life is difficult, you have to have something to hold on to or have someone who can hold on to you. And I think Lewis saw that, that was the Christian faith, that there may be antichrists in the world, but there is a Christ that will overcome
and
them.
Britain was nominally a Christian country.
That's right. So. And one of the great countries of the Protestant Reformation. I mean, when Dave and I went to England, we walked into a couple medieval cathedrals that were one-time Catholic and had become Anglican at the Protestant Reformation. And one of the scholars there said, yeah, this is an Anglo-Catholic church, you know, seeing that connection of historic Christianity. Well, let me introduce you to the third thing you may not know about C.S. Lewis. You know, you may not know that there are three C.S. Lewises. You may not know what a patriotic individual. By the way, one little last note about Lewis's patriotism. One of his jobs during World War II was to do guard duty around Oxford.
Right. Home,
so home guard. And so he would walk around Oxford at 3 a.m, you know, making sure that there were, because again, there was real concern that the Germans were going to invade the island. And so Lewis is doing his part. In all of that. The third thing you may not know about C.S. Lewis is that it was really, truly a miracle that he became a Christian. Now, why so? Because I think C.S. Lewis was born at one of the most secular periods in the modern world, maybe the most secular time period for Europe. Let me illustrate what I mean by that. Lewis is born in 1898. I mentioned he's born in Belfast, Ireland. I really do think Lewis pushed mere Christianity. That is, he wanted Catholics and Protestants to be friends because Ireland had had so much conflict among these two branches of Christendom. Well, Lewis is born in 1898, and the 50 years leading up to that are some of the most secular influential works are published. Let me mention just four of them. In the field of politics, the Communist Manifesto by Karl Marx is published in 1948. So 50 years before Lewis is born.
1848.
Sorry, 1848. Mm-hmm. So Lewis is born in 1898. This is 1848. The Origin of the Species in 1859 in science, politics, science. Friedrich Nietzsche, the German philosopher who's known for the God is Dead, wrote his book, The Gay Science, in 1882 in philosophy. And then in psychology, ever heard the name Sigmund Freud? Freud's book, Studies in Hysteria, published in 1895. This is an extremely secular period. So here we have books in politics, in science, in philosophy, in psychology. This is shaping Europe. In many ways, this is putting the nail in the coffin of Christian Europe. And Lewis initially is very influenced by that secularism. And I do want to talk a little bit about Lewis's journey. Lewis is born, of course, into a Christian family, an Anglican family. His father was a Christian. His mother was a Christian. He was baptized as an infant in the Anglican Church. His mother kind of gave him a spiritual foundation. She was very close with her two sons. And then she died at 9 years old. And by the way, one of the ties between Tolkien and Lewis, they had both lost their mother. Tolkien had lost both of his parents. He was an orphan at one point. And the Catholic Church, a priest took him in and cared for him until he was 21 years old. And that really influenced Tolkien toward Catholicism. But, you know, I've thought a lot about this. I know my mother lost her mom when she was 9 years old. And talk about pulling something, you know, your foundation for life is taken out of your life. And Lewis said after that, everything was turned upside down. Nothing was ever normal again. You know, the life that he knew in Ireland out there, it was taken away. And then Lewis also experienced a very difficult situation with his dad. I mentioned that his dad was a Christian. His dad liked literature. His father was a very successful attorney. Many ways, his father really did care about his son. But, you know, I the more I think about it, the more I think about McGrath's description of Lewis. What happens when your wife dies? I mean, my wife she's just an anchor of my life. She's my ally. When things go wrong, I know that she'll help me. I think Lewis's dad, Albert Lewis was his name. I think he lost his bearings, and maybe he didn't realize I got two boys here, and I need to be there for them. But, you know, who are we to judge? These are difficult experiences. You know, which of us have families where nothing goes wrong? I mean, you know, we all have situations where we realize we have feet of clay, that, you know, we need a savior. We need someone to hold on or hold on to us. Well, Albert probably made a bad decision. He sent both of his sons away to live in boarding schools in Britain. So now they're no longer in Ireland, they're in Britain. C.S. Lewis said that he thought when he first heard the Irish accent that it sounded devilish.
the British
accent. Yeah. He didn't like the English. Right. He liked to be known as an Irishman. I'm an Irishman. Well, that may have been step two. His mom's taken away. He's now his relationship with his dad is very difficult, and his dad was trained, really kind of tutored by a man named Kirkpatrick that Lewis would later call the Great Knock. Kirkpatrick used to be a Presbyterian minister who had become an atheist, and Kirkpatrick had taught Albert Lewis, C.S. Lewis's dad, and Warney, and that helped Warney get into the military. You know, his intellectual preparation was really astute. Well, then the decision was made to have C.S. Lewis tutored by Kirkpatrick, and there some of these great stories is that when C.S. Lewis met Kirkpatrick, he said, "Boy, isn't it a very lovely day, a nice day?" And Kirkpatrick says, "What do you know about nice? Have you looked at any geography? Do you know anything about this part of the country?" And he just, you know, took him apart. He says, "Why should you have any opinion at all about what kind of day it is?"
Wow.
So Lewis, rather than being intimidated by that, he really thought, "This guy's putting my ducks in a row." And he liked Kirkpatrick, but there are three steps in the loss of faith: the loss of Flora, his mother, then the difficult relationship with his dad, Albert, and then I think Kirkpatrick really just took apart any kind of religious idea. So when Lewis was 19 at Oxford, he thought religion is illusion; it's an invention of human beings.
And you mentioned the other scholars 50 years prior, so he was at least aware of those works.
Certainly, he was. You know, he was even as a young college kid. He was reading Freud, and there was discussions about people's behavior and sexual ideas that were deeply rooted in Sigmund Freud. I think Freud. This is a very strong claim, but I think you could make a case. Freud may be as influential in critiquing religion as even Darwin. Mm-hmm. So Lewis is deeply shaped by all of that, and all of that's percolating in Oxford. And so what happens? Lewis loses his faith. He meets religious people at Oxford, and he doesn't agree with them. And Lewis is not living a Christian lifestyle. You know, he deceives his father. He tells his father off. He takes his dad's money and then kind of tells him where to go. Lewis sexually is a man who is not guided by Christian ethics whatsoever. And yet Lewis becomes a Christian in the midst of all of this. And I think that there are a number of reasons why that happens. He meets Tolkien, and they're at Oxford, and they're talking, and Lewis goes home and writes in his diary, yeah, I met this cheeky chap, Tolkien, you know. I love all these little British expressions that they use of each other. But he says, you know, this guy's really engaging. And, Charles Williams, the very influential author, is a Christian. And Lewis is bumping into these other people who are his intellectual equals, who actually believe that Christianity is true. And there's all this discussion about the myth. Lewis is very interested in all of the ancient mythology, Norse mythology. His relationship with a man named Greaves, they have kind of a lifelong friendship because as young men, they were interested in Norse mythology. Lewis loves mythology, and people like Dyson and Tolkien, who were his intellectual equals at Oxford, who were Christians, said, but what you need to realize is Christianity is the true myth. Mm-hmm. God actually became man in time and space. And so all of these other mythical ideas are pointing, but Christianity is the true myth. And this has a huge influence. We talk a lot about apologetics. We talk about how do we persuade people of the truth of Christianity. I think in some respects, you have to have people who are your equal, who can challenge you, who can work with your ideas. And Lewis realized that people like Dyson and Tolkien and even Barfield, who was religious but not Christian, these were not people he could easily just dismiss. And, Lewis had also had a very difficult life. And so Lewis became convinced, first of all, that there was a God. So he became a theist first. And then later he became a Christian. And again, his association with his friends there at Oxford, particularly Tolkien. Tolkien was a little disappointed that when Lewis became a Christian, he became an Anglican instead of a Catholic. And there is a fellow, Ryan Reeves, who's a historian at Gordon-Conwell, very, very distinguished evangelical seminary in the East Coast, but it has other campuses in various places. Reeves was saying that maybe we should think about C.S. Lewis as the mere Christian Anglican and Lewis and Tolkien as the mere Christian Catholic. Mm-hmm. That both Tolkien and Lewis thought the basics of Christianity are more important than my particular church distinctives. Mm-hmm. And so they often talked about let's get the incarnation and the Trinity.
No, Tolkien never did write any apologetic works, if I'm correct here.
Well, the Silmarillion was one of them, but part of the dynamic of Lewis and Tolkien is Tolkien thought Lewis's apologetics was too pushy.
Yeah.
It was too explicit. Tolkien thought you need to be more subtle.
Right.
But the Silmarillion is what I understand. Tolkien's faith comes out more than in The Lord of the Rings.
Silmarillion. I mean, he does give a mythical sort of view of how God would be.
But you're right. Tolkien's more restrained.
I read somewhere that he, at one point in The Lord of the Rings, he went through and took out a lot of more explicit things they had originally included in there in order to make it more just influential, imaginatory, alternate sort of reality kind of approach to the Christian viewpoints.
Well, and, you know, as we think about Lewis becoming a Christian and Lewis's influence, and huge part of that influence overlaps with Tolkien, you know, there are these questions. I mean, we're in the business of Christian apologetics. We want to persuade people. Mm. We want to use apologetics at RTB, particularly science apologetics, to use it in our influential evangelism if we can. Well, how do people become persuaded? And like I mentioned, I mean, I bump into people who like C.S. Lewis, and they talk about Lewis as if there's one C.S. Lewis. It's the imaginative writer, right? And I say, well, have you read God in the Docks? Oh, no. How about Mere Christianity? No, I'm reading the literature, right?
Right.
You know, that's very interesting to me. I tend to think of apologetics in terms of arguments, and mm-hmm. I want to present philosophical and scientific arguments to, you know, to try to show that Christianity is valid and that it's true. But a lot of people read Lewis's novels. Mm-hmm. And the imaginative elements really persuade them. And, you know, I've thought more about that. You know, persuasion comes in many ways. Mm-hmm. And so these are three things. If I can just summarize them again, there may be three things you don't know about C.S. Lewis, mm-hmm. that there were really three C.S. Lewises. Second, that he was a patriot in two wars. And thirdly, that, it's a miracle when anybody becomes a Christian.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But it was a profound miracle. And, you know, this is one thing that I want to communicate to our listeners, that God can reach people in various ways and in very difficult circumstances. And so just because your kid, your child, has gone off to college and maybe lost their faith, God may call that child back. Mm-hmm. And, you know, C.S. Lewis is one of those people that you see that kind of influence in.
It's sort of analogous to the Apostle Paul. You'd never expect him to become a Christian, but that road to Damascus experience changed him.
The greatest conversion in the history of civilization.
And it's interesting that a person who has that kind of conversion often, or on at least occasionally, becomes very influential because they have a story to tell that's very powerful.
Well, you know, Joe, Walter Hooper came to Oxford and met Lewis in 1963, the last year of Lewis's life. And Walter Hooper became his secretary and was responsible for bringing a lot of Lewis's books back into print. And there were manuscripts that were not yet published, and Hooper was the one that was able to keep pushing that forward. I think even today he's the literary executive of the Lewis estate. But Hooper said that he thought, in meeting C.S. Lewis, he said that he thought Lewis believed the Christian faith the way Paul or Peter had believed the Christian faith. Hmm. And, of course, Hooper tells funny stories. He says when he first met Lewis and went to the kilns, he said, can I go to the bathroom? And you got to be careful about how you describe the laboratory. So Lewis played a joke on him and took him to the room where there was just a bath. There was no toilet. He gave him some towels and said, go ahead and take a bath. you know, it's the washroom or the toilet, the lube, as it is sometimes called. But these are three things you may not know about C.S. Lewis, and Lewis was a real man.
humanizes him.
Yeah.
You realize, I think that's the thing I like about reading these biographies, is that you see the kind of person that they really were. You don't idolize them and inappropriately. You can appreciate what they... I think that's especially true with Lewis, because Lewis does believe in things that we wouldn't consider strictly very evangelical.
That's right.
I've read recently kind of a book that summarized Lewis's theology. And, you know, I think, wow, where did he get that one from?
Yeah.
But you still appreciate him because you know there's a heart here.
Yeah.
There's a human being that has grown up in a certain environment. He's going to naturally fall into certain viewpoints that you, in a different environment, think about differently. And we're probably all in that category. There's always this, end-of-life retractions?
Yeah. Dave's waiting for my retractions book.
Well, you're not reaching the end of life.
No, you're probably not.
Hey, I have a decade or so before I write that book. Well, that's right. I mean, Lewis was not your typical evangelical. His view of, he didn't hold to an inerrant scripture. And his view of creation was probably something like theistic evolution. And other people have criticized him for involving too much in mythology, and there's truth in other myths or religions. So there are places, and the reality is that you can disagree with C.S. Lewis. And I would suspect he probably would be fine with that.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay to disagree.
Yeah. You know, Ken, one of my observations, kind of a take-home point with all of this, is you described his background, where he came from. He had been a Christian but then abandoned the faith. And then somewhere in the college years, it sounds like he had a really good friendship with these Inklings.
Yeah.
So I think that one of the points for me and perhaps others listening is that while we are here at RTB and other organizations are engaged in apologetics, you never know what a person's background is and what is going to cause them
trigger
to be
them.
Persuaded.
Yeah.
It could just be friendship with somebody and just over and over saying, you know, this is what the Christian faith is. Really is. People have objections. If you go on a college campus, the atheists or online or whatever, they will say, here are my objections. And they might be scientific, but the real objection might be something else.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. It's funny. I was reading an article just last night, and it was about retiring and retirement. And one of the guys was saying that what people really struggle with when they retire is they miss their colleagues. They miss those relationships
interactions.
And interactions that people had. And, you know, there is something called friendship evangelism, where you develop relationships. And I think there are times where you can have a relationship with someone and you may have some pretty sharp disagreements. But Lewis viewed friendship as a type of love. And, you know, those friendships...
He has a book on it, The Four Loves.
The Four Loves, 1960. So this is, you know, this idea that you can have and build relationships with people that you disagree with. But it keeps that door open.
Mm-hmm.
Let me recommend a few books. Alistair McGrath has a biography. It was published in 2013, so it was the 50th anniversary. And probably the headline in that book is that I think McGrath makes a pretty good case that Lewis probably became a Christian a little later than what a lot of people thought. McGrath insists that Lewis wasn't very good at keeping dates, and so Lewis probably became a Christian a year later than he actually did. But I thought that McGrath also gives you a lot of discussion of the human C.S. Lewis. And I appreciate what Davis said. I feel more appreciative of C.S. Lewis, knowing that he was a broken man, knowing that, you know, he was a person who did things in his life that I wouldn't approve of,
mm-hmm.
That he was a person who sinned and needed saving. It's a really good book entitled C.S. Lewis, A Life, Eccentric Genius, Reluctant Prophet, Tyndale, 2013. I've read it a couple times. A couple of other books that I think are really helpful. Let me pull them out here. This will kind of take us into our next program, but I think it's very helpful. Let's see here. Yeah. Another philosopher, Richard Pertill. Pertill became a Catholic. Pertill wrote a book, C.S. Lewis's Case for the Christian Faith. And I think Pertill does a really good job of kind of explaining C.S. Lewis's approach to apologetics. So there's one on his life and then one on his thinking. And, you know, Lewis is an institution. I mean, I think it was as early as the 50s that one scholar, I think here in America, received a PhD on C.S. Lewis. So, you know, you can go to the C.S. Lewis Society. You know, there's a lot out there on C.S. Lewis.
I would really recommend that book, too, by Marsden, George Marsden.
George Marsden. Is this the book on Mere Christianity?
Yeah.
What, I like
Do you have the title, explicitly the title of it there?
I don't believe I do.
But it's a book about Mere Christianity.
Yes.
Telling kind of the history of it, how it was written, what was initial motivation for it, and how it was accumulated into a book, these original talks that he gave, and then what people's response to it has been over the years. It's fascinating.
Yeah, it's... You know, you write a book, and I suspect, Joe, that Lewis would be shocked, because Lewis did tell Walter Hooper, 5 years after I'm dead, nobody will remember me. And 55 years after Lewis is dead, his books sell better than they did during his life.
Right. So, you think anyone will write a book about one of your books?
I want to know if somebody's going to go to Riverside and say, where was Ken Sample's bedroom at? Can I take a walk through? How much tea or Coke did Ken drink? I tend to doubt it. Now, with Hugh Ross, that might have already happened.
Yeah, right.
That's right.
But there'd be no tea. Hugh's not a tea drinker. Certainly not an alcohol drinker. Yeah.
Three pots, wow. Well, great stuff, Ken. Thank you so much for enlightening us. I think people will know three more things now about Lewis that they perhaps didn't know. We're going to talk about Lewis again in the next podcast,
right.
So be sure to listen for that. For Ken Samples and Dave Rogstad, this is Joe Aguirre with a reminder that the goal of apologetics is not victory but truth. Thanks for listening, and join us for the next edition of Straight Thinking.
Thank you for listening. Your prayers and financial support are reaching people with reasons for faith in Jesus Christ, our Creator and Savior. To allow Reasons to Believe programs like this to continue, make your gift today at reasons.org.